I am Planta on the line. This is the commentary.ca. I was 7 years old when the Berlin Wall came down, and so a lot of my knowledge about the end of the Cold War comes from a reading and viewing of history. However, there's a lot of what the historian Tony Jutt calls mismemory. It seems there's a lot we don't clearly know. A new book, in time for the 20th anniversary of the fall of the wall, sheds light on what happened in 1989. The year that changed the world, the untold story behind the fall of the Berlin Wall, is an eyewitness account of the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe from Michael Meyer, who at the time was Newsweek's bureau chief in Germany, Central Europe, and the Balkans. It is a tremendous, riveting book. It reads like a novel in some parts. Michael Meyer is currently the Director of Communications for the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and he joins me from New York City this day. He's also the author of Alexander Complex. The Year That Changed the World is published by Scribner. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Michael Meyer. Good morning, Mr. Meyer.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Yourself?
Great.
There's a story in the book where you'd encountered, a German soldier or a Russian soldier, I can't remember now, smoking a cigarette standing atop a pile of garbage, and he spit at you? Is that correct?
Yes, that's a good story. Thank you for remembering it. It was a Russian soldier.
Okay.
And I had been going around what was still East Germany after the wall came down, and Westerners, journalists were going all over because suddenly all the borders were open, and the Russians had half a million troops in the Red Army stationed in East Germany, and it made for some weird encounters. You'd be driving across a country road, and suddenly this line of tanks would come racing across the field, and they'd be flying the red flag of the Soviet Union. It was like being back in the middle of World War II. But in this case, the soldiers, I was trying to find some to talk to, and one man told me, well, go to the dump, because a lot of West Berlin stuff was dumped in the east. And here were these captains and colonels and lieutenants from the Red Army, poking through stinking refuse, looking for bits of treasure to take back to the Soviet Union after conquering Nazi Germany, in 1945, they were looking for their payback. And one of them had a bit of torn carpet under his arm and a teddy bear with one eye and, a couple of other bits of stuff he'd salvaged. And, he looked at me, and I had rented driven up in a rented red Mercedes convertible. I got out of this thing and wanted to talk to him, and he took one look at me, took a drag on his cigarette, and then spat at my feet. Me, the symbol of my Western arrogance, we won the Cold War, forgetting, of course, that it was the Russians who fought from the gates of Moscow all the way to Berlin and played a huge role, of course, perhaps greater than even ours, in defeating Hitler.
What did you learn at that moment that he spit at you?
Humility.
Yeah.
The dangers of myth-making. You talk about the quixotic quality of memory, or the manipulation of history. If you ask an American, I come from the Midwest. I spent a lot of time in Michigan and upstate New York. That's where I grew up. And I go back all the time. And if you were 7 years old when the Berlin Wall came down, a lot of these folks are older. But it was a very vivid event in Ohio or Michigan or what have you. But it's a kind of memory that 20 years later is not exactly immediate. And so when you go out and ask people what they remember about the Cold War and the Berlin Wall, many say 8 out of 10, I'd estimate. Remember Ronald Reagan's famous quote, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." And then it happened. And we forget that there were 2 years and more between the statement and the fact. And yet, in the popular mind, we equate them. And even in a certain circle of American foreign policy, that speech and the Gipper's, stand firm approach to communism has become a shorthand for a whole worldview. And if I had to sum it up, it would be, stand tall against the dictator, confront him, hollow at the core, he will collapse, the people and freed will rise up rejoicing, democracy will bloom. Because that's what seems to have happened in Eastern Europe when the wall came down and after decades of confrontation. And it's a sort of triumphalist view. We won the Cold War. And it's a very short leap from the idea that all you have to do is confront the dictator and he will fall to our misadventure in Iraq, where, yes, the dictator fell, but peace and democracy did not bloom overnight.
Now, when was it that you arrived in Europe there for Newsweek? Was that 88 or so?
Yeah, I got there, and I took my first trip in the summer of 88 and arrived in earnest in the fall. And I could see, with Gorbachev in power, the Soviet premier of the time, who was putting all sorts of changes in place, trying to rebuild communism for the better and put a human face on it. With Gorbachev in power, it was obvious that there were going to be great changes. And I sort of thought I'd have a year or maybe two to see this part of Europe, half of Europe, behind the Iron Curtain, that had been as if under glass for the last 50 years. And it was like stepping on a magic carpet. It was an unbelievable ride, first because you saw what it was like to live under communism, and then suddenly revolution swept the region, and it was as romantic and dramatic as you could possibly imagine.
So after the wall came down, it's known now that people in the American government, the State Department, said, you know, were quoted as saying, we never saw it coming. You, having been on the ground there, did you have a sense that it was to happen?
Well,
the end of the Cold War?
It is true. A lot of people didn't see it coming. Even those who paid close attention and actually knew, you know, what was happening in terms of events, nobody, very few people, even Americans certainly, but even many Germans, for example, where I was living, didn't see it coming. But I got a funny sense. When I arrived in, let me just back up. Some people ask me what the most dramatic moment of my time in that incredibly dramatic year was, and they assume it was standing in East Berlin when the Berlin Wall fell.
Right.
Dramatic as that was, no. The most dramatic moment was when I realized that something huge, something momentous was coming down. And that was in December of 88. And I had read in a Reuters wire about something happening in Budapest in Hungary. I always wanted to see Budapest, very scenic, beautiful city. And they were talking about creating a stock market, you know, experimenting with capitalism and free markets, talking about maybe letting political clubs form, as they called them, which I wondered, gee, could those become political parties? And then they began talking about free elections, and so I thought, well, you know, this is sort of uncommunistic. I'd better go see what's up. And so I went, and I had this incredible series of meetings with communists, but a new government that had just taken office about 3 weeks earlier, and who were saying the most uncommunist things. I went to meet the justice minister of this new government. Now, a justice minister, sort of as it sounds, is straight out of 1984, you know, Orwell. He's the guy who throws dissidents in jail. He runs the secret police. He, you know, manipulates the laws that throws enemies of the people in jail. And so I went expecting this sort of beefy-necked, classic communist apparatchik, and instead I found this learned, educated, sophisticated, funny, human man. And we started talking, and I said, well, what about these elections? What about political parties and clubs? And he said, it's all true. And I said, well, I sort of laughed. He said, you hold an election and you lose, you're going to step down? Because communists had held these fake elections for years, and of course the Communist Party never failed to win less than 99% of the vote. And he laughed and said, yes, as though this were the most natural thing in the world. And I looked very skeptical, and he said, Mr. Meyer, you don't believe me? And I said, no. And so he pulled open the drawer of his desk, and he took out a pamphlet, and he waved it over his head very theatrically and said, Mr. Meyer, what do you think this is? No idea. It was a copy of the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. Bill of Rights. He said, Mr. Meyer, mark my words, these will be ours in 9 months. He was only off by 1 month. It took 10 months. But at that moment, I knew what was happening. The hair literally rose in the back of my neck because I said, something momentous is happening here, something that's going to change the world. And I felt like I was present at the beginning of something huge.
And now the wall itself coming down, you talk about that in the book, about what happened that night. I guess that was the 6th of November.
9th of November.
The 9th of November, pardon me. What happened, the guy's name is Gunter, I'm going to louse this up, Gunter Schabowski. Perfect. He was a spokesman for the Politburo, and he was on television that night, and he screwed up.
He screwed up. It's the British, what they call the British cock-up theory of history, you know.
Yeah.
History, we often see, is the culmination of tectonic forces grinding away. Well, sometimes history is made by accident, and this is one of the most memorable cases that people will be talking about it for generations. What happened was this man, Gunter Schabowski, was the party spokesman of the Communist Party. Now, there was a new government in East Germany. They had ousted the old dictator Erich Honecker, and they wanted to put change in motion, a lot like Gorbachev. And what was happening is that there were a lot of street demonstrations in Germany, and a lot of East Germans had escaped that summer to West Germany across the border from Hungary. Thousands of people, tens of thousands of people were leaving, and they wanted to stop it. And they knew that their fellow countrymen, East Germans, wanted one thing above all else, and that was the freedom to travel. Sure, freedom to vote, sure, freedom to talk, but above all, freedom to travel to see the world, just like anybody else. And so the new government decided to give them that right. They were going to issue passports, and they had a plan. They were going to issue passports, and people would line up, and they would get a stamp on their passport, a stempel. There'd be orderly rows of East Germans, and they had the laws passed that afternoon of November 9th in the East German parliament, and the head of the party had the rules and regulations all drawn up. He had the press release drawn up. And when the spokesman came by, who hadn't been on the meetings, who had been on 3 days of vacation, he just came back to give this press conference. He stopped by the man's office and said, "Got anything to announce?" And the head of the party said, "No, no." They said, "Wait a minute. Here, take this. This will do us a great deal of good." A power of good was his exact phrase. Gunter Schabowski took the press release. He read it in his car going over to the press conference. It was a big thing. It was going to be the right to travel. And so he read it off at the press conference, live to the nation, with international camera crews present, BBC, CNN, local television. And when somebody asked a question after he read it out, he said, "When does this new rule take effect? When will people be allowed to travel?" Well, Gunter Schabowski scanned the press release. The only words he saw were "immediately" in German, "sofort." And so what did he say? He said, "Sofort, right now." The problem was that it was supposed to all take effect the next morning. So none of the border guards had been notified. The visas weren't ready. The stamps weren't ready. But people didn't know that. Gunter Schabowski didn't know that. So everybody who saw this on the radio and television, was to say everybody in the country, went running to Checkpoint Charlie and other places, you know, demanding to be let out. And I was there watching it happen. You know, 100 people showed up, 200 people. We even picked up some hitchhikers and took them to the east side of Checkpoint Charlie. And, 500... and 1,000, and 2,000, 10,000. And after a couple of hours, you know, the border guards had loaded guns. There were dogs. There were searchlights, barbed wire. It was a cold night. You know, your breath would frost in the air, and you had this weird spectacle with thousands of people building up in the border, pushing closer and closer to the border guards until it was only maybe 5-10 feet between them. They were so close that the breath of their dogs and the guards mingled with the people who had been protesting in the streets of Berlin and Leipzig. I mean, it was a very tense situation. And I watched the captain of the border guard at Checkpoint Charlie sitting in the glass box, dialing for instructions, dialing and dialing. But everybody had disappeared after Schabowski made his botch. The head of the party went off to the opera. The head of the interior ministry with the bower of his mistress. There was nobody to say anything, and those who could be reached were too scared to say anything, which is the nature of a communist bureaucracy. And so nobody did anything. And finally, one border guard sort of shrugged his shoulders, just like Gunter Schabowski shrugged his shoulders when he was asked, "When does this take effect?" and said, "Right now." The border guard captain said, "Well, open them up, ourself." And the gates opened, and it was like pulling the plug on a bathtub of dirty water. It just ran out, and that's how the wall came down.
This might seem like a stupid question, but were there people from the West who wanted to go to the East at that moment?
Yeah, there were lots of people wanting to go to the East as tourists to see what it was like.
Yeah.
No, nobody wanted to live there. It was horrible.
Yeah.
You can't imagine. I mean, people are, these days, 20 years later, romanticize it, Germans especially, East Germans. They called it Ostalgia because Ost means East, nostalgia for the old East. You know, the security of health care, universal education, subsidies for fuel, transportation. There are a lot of good things in a socialist system, but of course the economy couldn't pay for it, so it was behind the scenes just crumbling. And then one out of every 60 people was an East German spy informing on one another's neighbors. It, East Germans talked about this sticky air, that everything you said would be heard, and they'd tell very dark jokes. You know, there's a joke, you know, two secret police are sitting at a bar at a pub. One looks at the other and says, "Are you thinking what I'm thinking?" And the other man says, "Yes, comrade, you're under arrest."
Yeah.
You know, because they're both thinking what a lousy system this is. And that's grounds for arrest.
Is it a myth that the Eastern Europeans at the time wanted capitalism, or did they want something else?
Well, if you're stuck behind an Iron Curtain being reported on all the time by your neighbors, living in fear of being sent to jail if you step out of line or losing your perks, if you criticize the regime, you know, you may not be arrested, but you lose your job, or your wife will lose her job, you can't get the surgery you need when you get sick, you can't travel to the West, on and on and on and on and on. So people were very circumspect about saying what they wanted. But also you've got to remember, if you don't have experience of capitalism, you don't know what it is. People can say they want it, but then when they get it, they discover that, well, it can be pretty rough. When you lose your jobs and have no social safety net, life gets tough real fast. And a lot of East Germans had trouble adapting to a capitalist system. Even if they thought, gee, it would be great when they were living in the East.
This idea, though, that capitalism equals freedom, I guess this is one of those myths, like Reagan telling Gorbachev to tear down the wall, that it actually is that's what it is. Is that right?
There's a lot of confusion. People would shout out freedom not knowing what it is. When the wall came down, freedom meant, first of all, freedom to shop. And the West German government gave any East German visitor 100 Deutschmarks, about 50 bucks at the time, to do with as they will. And people went shopping, and they went around these stores looking at the incredible merchandise as though they were, you know, aliens from another planet. The freedom to live without a social safety net was a far more sobering truth, learned at leisure years later, and it's no accident that many felt nostalgic for a safer and more secure world, even if it wasn't sustainable.
Now, was the prosperity that was promised as widespread as we'd been led to believe? I mean, are there people doing better now than during the Cold War?
There are a lot of people doing a lot better. Older people had more trouble making the adjustment. Young people thrive. But look, it's an ambiguous picture. East Germany got bailed out by West Germany. It was basically a hostile acquisition. But people weren't allowed to fail. Communities weren't allowed to fail. In Romania, the government just collapsed yesterday, because the economy is just falling apart. They have not learned the secret of capitalism, particularly in an economic downturn such as we've seen worldwide. East Europeans are getting hammered. There's a lot of nostalgia for the old way.
You're the last American journalist to interview Ceausescu. Did you ever meet his wife?
I did.
What was she like?
He was a devil incarnate. They were raw evil, and she was even more than he. She was the one who wanted to shoot Romanian demonstrators in the streets. When three generals, when the revolution unrest first broke out in Romania in early December of 89 in a town in the near the Hungarian border called Timișoara. Three generals didn't crack down as the Ceausescus thought they ought to. They didn't shoot people. They arrested a lot. Elena Ceausescu was screaming at them, according to the minutes of a meeting I got, and it was essentially, if you had fired on them, they would have scampered in their holes like scared rabbits and never came out. You should have burned them. You should have scorched them. And by that, she means scorched them with fire, killed hundreds. And the generals, you know, she threatened them with execution, going up in front of a firing squad. And the generals did crack down a day or two later, and they shot quite a few people. Elena Ceausescu fainted. She and her husband were caught trying to flee. They were trying to get to an army base where they would have found sanctuary, and maybe the story of Eastern Europe's revolutions would have been quite different had they succeeded. But they were being tracked electronically by Hungarian intelligence, who were helping those in pursuit of them capture them. And they were captured. They were taken to an army base. They were put on trial, a show trial. It lasted about 45 minutes, and they were pulled out afterwards and shot down. Elena Ceausescu fainted before she was stood in front of the firing squad, and they simply riddled it with bullets where she lay.
Were you there?
I wasn't there for that. I got there a day later, but I was taken by a Secret Service agent who was my handler. I never saw him when I was there, but I visited Romania in August, and the Secret Service handler, who followed me everywhere, invisible to me, I thought I was being pretty clever in losing these guys, took me to the house where the Ceausescus had fled from the night before. And I went through Elena Ceausescu's boudoir, and you know, the secret police had looted everything in there, perfumes, and I saw everything, you know, that she used, her kinds of perfume, her negligees, this, that, even the hemorrhoidal balm she used on her hemorrhoids was there. That's not too grotesque, but it tells you how personal, intimate a last view I got. I also went to the dictator's belongings. By his bed, there was a memo he'd been reading. I don't know whether it was a plan or whether it was the real deal, analyzing the potential for a popular uprising in Romania and how he should best respond. I think it was planted there by the secret police, who actually, the revolution in Romania was a coup worked by the Securitate, the secret police, disguised as a popular revolution. When the popular revolution began in the city Timișoara I mentioned, the secret police went into action and realized that this was their opportunity to dump this hated dictator, and they did so. And it's one of the reasons why Ceausescu was given this show trial and executed so quickly. They wanted him out of the way.
Well, was the execution, because I saw it on YouTube last night, was that shown live on television? Or
it was shown live on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
I watched it in the lobby of the Intercontinental Hotel in downtown Bucharest, and outside you'd look out the windows and the National Library was burning and the Central Committee headquarters was burning and there was debris all over. There weren't any bodies lying in the street still, but there were tanks firing and sniper fire this place and that place, and the windows, as I say, were shot out. There was no electricity except as provided by candles and a generator. But they had this TV, and in the gloom, the darkness of this cavernous, communist, broken marble lobby, freezing, there was this TV, and this program came on. There was this revolutionary group called the National Salvation Front. It showed the members of this, then it showed a video. The screen went blank, then a video came on, and we realized we were watching the trial of Ceausescu, and then there was a break in the video after the, you know, some clips of the trial, and then there was a scene of these pile of rags in the distance, and then the camera sort of closed in, and there was Elena and Nicolae Ceausescu lying on, you know, near a puddle on broken brick, shot. And the thing about Ceausescu was that it went right up to his face, and his eyes were open, staring sightlessly at the sky, these pitiless blue, sightless eyes, and they were the exact eyes that looked at me when I interviewed him in the summer, and I asked him a question about why his people hated him so much, and he just stopped this rant he'd been on, and he looked at me with the look of a man who would have had me killed without a moment of hesitation had I not been a correspondent protected by Newsweek. Cold eyes, fish eyes, but very intelligent eyes, if a fish could think.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned in the preface of the book that you'd written an initial draft of the book 10 years ago, and it seems not too long ago, but it seems long ago when you think about how the world's changed in 10 years. What's the lesson we should take away from 1989?
Well, you know, when I wrote the first manuscript here, it was 10 years after the fact, and the publisher said, "Too soon for history, too late for current affairs." Fine, I'll wait for the 20th anniversary, I said to myself. But the thing is, I went back and I began re-interviewing these characters and putting everything together, and new CIA documents were released showing that the CIA completely missed the revolutions in Eastern Europe. We had no clue, and the documents made that clear. Well, why do we have no clue, I wondered? How could it be so invisible? You know, particularly to people who were so smart. They were very smart people in, you know, the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration. You know, Condi Rice, Richard Cheney, all these people missed it completely. They dismissed Gorbachev as a propagandist who was, you know, intent on getting us to lower our nuclear guard so this Red Army could roll through the Fulda Gap to Frankfurt, the English Channel. And my goodness, you know, you had to be missing an awful lot to think that. And when you begin to think, well, you begin to rethink of what you yourself saw. What was it you thought you saw as opposed to what was real? And I began thinking more critically about the presumption that the United States had won the Cold War. We did win the Cold War, but this triumphal, "we won," is much more textured, much more ambiguous. The way the revolutions came to pass, East Europeans rose up. They won. Yes, they were emboldened by our example. Yes, the Marshall Plan. Yes, containment. Yes, all the rest. We were huge. But in the final days, it was East Europeans who won the Cold War for themselves. And Ronald Reagan's rhetoric was resounding and courageous, and it was, as a speechwriter at the UN, I wish I had written that great line. But it was a line, you know. And to mistake that for factuality and to base policy as an article of faith on this is to really get into dangerous territory. It's to rewrite history in the same way that communists rewrote history. It's to go back to your opening question, that when you rewrite history, when you get too far away from reality, history has a way of coming back and biting you, and it bites you hard, right in the butt.
Michael, I so appreciate your time today. This is a marvelously written account of what happened 20 years ago. It's a timely book. Congratulations and continued good luck with it.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much. The book is called The Year That Changed the World, The Untold Story Behind the Fall of the Berlin Wall. It's published by Scribner. Do buy this book. It's a really great read. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.